Good morning. And good morning. So this morning, I'd like to talk about a couple practices, actually three practices, to loosen ego rigidity. I've talked about these before. I'm going to talk about two briefly and then one in more detail, but I'm going to keep my talk short so we can have some conversation. And maybe some of you will be brave enough to use examples, not from your own life, but from someone else's life. So first of all, Zen Buddhism emphasizes sitting. But the Buddhist pantheon has lots of other ways besides sitting meditation to loosen ego rigidity. Zen tends to not emphasize all these other things. Because why? Because Zen teachers are afraid that we get involved in this exercise to lose ego rigidity. And what happens? The exercise creates a new rigidity. A new rigidity. That I'm doing this. Am I getting it right? Am I getting calmer? Am I getting more, you know, and I'm comparing how I'm doing with how she's doing, with how I should have been doing, if I was really doing it right. So in Zen, you don't have too much of this. But Zen is Buddhism. And Buddhist psychology has lots of tips about loosening. So I think it's important to pay attention to them. Sitting is our main practice. Meditation is our main practice. But even in meditation, we can do this, exactly the same thing in meditation. Meditation can be a way of strengthening ego rigidity, even though you think you're loosening it, right? Because you're my meditation, my zazen, and those people bothering me, and their zazen is no good. And after all these years, why are they behaving the way they behave? Maybe I should just quit zazen, or they're not doing real zazen, et cetera, right? So it can strengthen each ego rigidity. Anything you do can. So this is a little tricky. A little tricky for us as human beings. Some of the Zen teachers don't even the sitting. They say, just as you know, our teacher Dogen Zenji says, just sit. He won't give us. He'll give no technique because of that very problem. But today we're going to talk a little bit about some techniques. We need to remember that the techniques are to open us up so that we come back to our original still nature, the stillness of the universe that's always here. That's what they're for. And if they do anything else, we're being seduced by our ego needs. So we can just need to pay attention to that. So first I'm going to tell a story from the Lotus Sutra, which was Dogen, this historical founder of Soto Zen, really liked the Lotus Sutra a lot. And we haven't studied it here since Katagiri Roshi died. I'm not sure why. Maybe we should. I think we should. One of the stories from the Lotus Sutra, which I've told before, but which is about this very issue of using technique to come back to stillness. And I'll tell. So this is a story of the prodigal son. Not the prodigal son in Christianity, the prodigal son in Buddhism. Father and son live together, and they're poor family, and the son gets separated from his father somehow due to some circumstance and doesn't see his father, doesn't know where his father is, and wanders away and is gone for a long time. And meanwhile, his father, who is very poor, they live in this ramshackle hut, his father, meanwhile, becomes very wealthy. So wealthy that he has a fine castle and a retinue of gardeners and cooks and employees, I guess. and uh, So, but the father really misses his son, and has no idea where his son is. But his son then kind of stumbles into this kingdom of this rich man, and he stumbles in, and the father sees the son, and he recognizes it, and he runs up to him, but the son runs away. Who is this guy chasing me? I don't know this guy with all this wealth and all these servants. I don't know this guy. So then what does the father do? The father said, my son's running away from me. Well, he's scared. He doesn't know me. He doesn't recognize me amidst all this wealth, all this opulence. So what am I going to do? Well, I guess I can have someone hire my son to work as a gardener in my kingdom. So he hires someone to have his son work in the... He has his chief gardener hire his son to work in the garden. And then the king disguises himself, takes off his fancy clothes, and begins working in the garden himself. And so they hang out together, and the son thinks, oh, this is a nice man. This man reminds me of someone. And then the next thing the king does is tell his chief gardener, well, I think this young man could be a cook. I think he could be a cook. And we need a cook. We need an assistant cook in my castle. And so the head gardener says to the young man, well, you can have a job in the castle as a cook. And he said, oh, really? I don't know. I've never been in a castle before. He said, yes, we're offering you a job in the castle. So he goes into the castle. He's a cook in the castle. Well, the story goes on in different versions. But finally, the son is comfortable enough just being in the palace, in this wealth, in this comfort, so that the son, when he's serving the father says, "Come sit by me. Come sit by me." Oh, okay, I'll come sit by this man. And then he reaches out his hand and touches him, the father. He says, I'm your father. And by this time, the son is ready to accept it. Oh! And then he cries. He cries. And they both cry. So this is a story about how we get lost. How we get lost from our true nature and how it's always here. But we need some encouragement to believe that it's here. We need some encouragement. And encouragement can be technique. Well, I'll put you to work in the garden. Well, I'll make you a cook. Till you get comfortable enough to really open up and believe that right here is your Buddha nature. That right here is your stillness. That formlessness is always present right here. But it takes a while because you don't believe it. So that's the Lotus Sutra's reason for having technique. Doing these techniques, or any techniques. Okay, so three techniques. The first one, which come from the Theravadan tradition, and then the Tibetans use them. The first one is practicing noticing when you put the self first. And the story about that that's often told is of the monk, and they're in the food line and they're getting their soup, and one of the monks shouts out, thief, thief. Do you know this one? I've told it before. Thief, thief. And and everybody looks, where's the thief? Where's the thief? And they look at the monk, where's the thief? And he said, he's here. He points to himself. I was hoping the cook would dip the ladle deep into the soup pot so I could get thicker soup than the rest of you. So that's the practice of watching when we put the self first, which we do a whole bunch. We do a whole bunch because we feel needy, we feel insecure, we feel like people don't pay attention to us, or we're not getting our needs met. So that's an important practice, and I've done that practice some over the years. I need to do that practice, especially because I'm a first child and a male, and I'm not only the first child and a male, I'm the first grandchild. So the first grandchild and a male means that I was used to as a child. I'll tell you, so I'm still saying I'm used to, because I am. I'm used to thinking that if those cookies are in the plate, that they're for me. My grandmother baked them for me. She always did. They're for me. So I really have to pay attention to this one. Specifically with cookies. Very specifically with cookies. I kid you not. But the caveat about this one is that, and the scriptures don't talk about this, but that if you're habituated to putting the self last, don't do this practice. Don't do this practice. Because instead of doing it that way, you should say, not last with cookies. Because if you're habituated to being last, that's habit two. That also keeps you from just being here, just being open, just really enjoying your life. So that's the first practice. Second practice is the Tibetans call driving all blame into one. But again, it comes from the Theravadin tradition, driving all blame into one. And that one is whenever you react emotionally to what someone says or does, regardless of how off the wall they are or how hurtful they are, you look at your own pattern. You look at your own, what is it about my habit pattern and my reactivity that's causing this? I mean, they're causing it too, but we have control. We ultimately have control over how we react. So what is it? What is it? So driving all blame into one means is that whatever they do, I come back to what's the button being pushed here in me? And don't worry about them. This is my practice. This is my life. And what is it that habitually I'm doing here to send off all kinds of flares, all kinds of emotional reaction, all kinds of spinning out? That way we're not so passive. We bring some careful attention, some loving attention and awareness to these patterns, and they begin to fall apart on their own, little by little. Again, we have the same problem with this one as with the first one. If you're a person who's already conflict avoidant, if you're conflict avoidant by nature, I wouldn't do this practice. I would do the opposite practice. If you're conflict avoidant by nature and you're driving all blames into one, you're getting more and more rigid internally about how I'm not gonna deal with that person. I'm just gonna put it on myself, and then you get heavier and heavier. So, if you're conflict avoidant, don't do it. Don't do it. Do it the other way.
You're
right. Well. No, wait a second. I don't think so. I don't think so. Okay, so those are the two. Then the one I want to spend more time on and talk about is the skandhas, is the aggregates, which I've talked a lot about over the years. But it's been probably 6 or 9 months since I talked about them. So in Buddhism, we say there is no self, really, right? There are the five aggregates. That there is my immediate sense experience, rupa. There is the felt sense that I have about my immediate sense experience, vedana. There are the perceptions that I have that come from my immediate sensory experience and the felt sense, samnya. There is what I make of that, samskara. What I make of all that stuff, samskara. I talk more about that because that's very problematic. What I make of that emotionally. It's usually an emotional an emotion is what I make of it, some kind of emotion. And then how I interpret Vijnana, how I interpret what monkey mind does with it. What monkey mind does with it. So those are the five components of what we call self. There isn't any self there. There are just these five things going on. There's a sensory experience. There's a felt sense. There's a perception. There's an emotion. And there's an interpretation and the chatter that goes along with that interpretation. Okay? So that's the deal. Those are the aggregates. So how do we work with them in Buddhism? Well, there are three ways that we work with them. And this one, I've worked on this one a lot for the last 15 or 20 years. Although my teachers did not teach in Japanese, and you do not learn these things. But Buddhism is huge. There's lots of stuff we can learn in Buddhism. So usually, what happens? Usually, our energy is all spent in the last two, in the emotion and the interpretation of the experience. And if we're more thinking types, we more work on it's more the thoughts and the interpretations and. And if we're more feeling types, it's the emotion. But it's really both. And we don't spend much time with the first three, with just the sensory experience, with just the felt sense, with just the simple perception. We're off to the races. Four and five, our whole lives become the emotion and the interpretation. The emotion and the interpretation. And more different interpretations activate different emotions that we even forgotten about, which make us remember other incidents as we're similar, and on and on and on, right? So, the three practices. Well, I'll give an experience. I'll give an example. This is not actually something that happened, but it could happen for me. It could happen. So I go to this Soto Zen Buddhist Association. It's Zen teachers. I go to their conference every couple of years. Just young teachers like me. So let's say that I'm chatting with a guy, and I hear some other people, because you know we all the Zen teachers get together, and what are they doing? They're all doing samskaras and vijnanas. They're all doing and comparing their centers to other people's centers. Thinking about themselves, having different emotion. Oh, you know, because we're human beings, right? I think we should spend more time doing zazen at those conferences. But anyway, that's a different issue. So I'm chatting with someone, and I hear in the background another conversation going on in the next room, but the door's not closed. And in that conversation, the guy is saying something like, you know, that guy Tim Burka at Minnesota Zen Meditation. What he is doing is not traditional, and I wonder if it's what it's worth or something like that. Okay, so let's say theoretically, but this would probably be true, that I have some emotional response, like I think, oh, I'm dismayed. I went, who said that? That's number five. Who said that? That's my monkey mind. Who said that? Number four, the samskara, is my dismay. And then I think to myself, number five, fifth skanda, which is interpretation, I think, well, who said that? What do they mean by that? Are they putting me down? They're putting me down. Then I come back to the fourth one, which is anger. And then that anger reminds me that I don't even know if I want to be there at all, which is the fifth one. The interpretation is, geez, I gave up my good time to come here. And here they are criticizing me. And then maybe that leads into some sadness. Back to the fourth one, right? Because I miss my wife, I miss you guys, and here I am listening to these people criticize me. I came halfway across the country, right? So then I... The fourth and the fifth. You understand? This is our lives. We and it It all happens with samskara. We make something out of it. As soon as we make something out of it, we create a whole world, a vijnana world, a consciousness world, a world of interpretation and response and commentary, and then it's fed by emotion. Emotion feeds it. So it's a fire. Okay? Let's say that happens to me. Then what are the three practices I can do? Three practices that are outlined in Theravadan and Tibetan teaching. First, I can bring the aggregates into view. I'm reviewing them, but I'm bringing them into view. I'm saying, excuse me, the guy I'm talking with, I'm going to the bathroom or someplace, you know, and I'm just being quiet. I'm bringing the aggregates into view. And that means I see my emotion, I see my anger, I see my interpretation, and I go back and I say, well, what did I hear that person say? The first aggregate was what I heard. Usually we don't even hear very well. We just hear a little bit of something, and already we're off running on the fourth and the fifth. So this now I'm in quiet in the bathroom, and what did I hear? I heard him say that fellow Tim Burkett is not doing a very traditional teaching. I don't know if it'll last. Well, I hear that, and then my felt sense is a sense of kind of felt senses are only positive, negative, and neutral. So it's a negative felt sense, and it's in my shoulders. I feel it in my shoulders because that's where I tend to feel negative emotion, in my shoulders. You guys may feel it different places, but it's in my shoulders. Of course, we all feel it different places. So that's my felt sense in my shoulders. Then what's my perception? My perception is, oh, he's making some critical comments. And then I go back and I do the emotion again. I say, well, the emotion now is still anger, but there's actually some confusion there because I really don't know now when I really pay attention to what he said whether I was being criticized. And then the interpretation is a little different too. So that's bringing the aggregates into view. And if we bring all five of them into view, it depotentiates our reaction, depotentiates our experience. It's inevitable that it happens. If you really do it, you have to do it quietly, and you have to do it by holding in abeyance monkey mind, holding in abeyance the fifth aggregate. If you don't hold the fifth aggregate into abeyance, you can't do it. So that's the first way of working with it, with the five aggregates, to depotentiate the fictional self, right? Depotentiate that guy, that made-up guy, who serves an important role in society, but is still made up. That's the first way. Second way, which you can do after the first way or another time, is to come back to go through the whole process like I did, and then come back to the interpretation and say, well, are there other interpretations? Well, there are lots of other interpretations for just about any sense experience. There are a multiplicity of them. So one interpretation is that guy was not criticizing me, that he was just saying he didn't know if it would last because he really believes in the traditions, and someone who's he thinks is compromising tradition, he doesn't know if that's going to last. So it's not. So that's another interpretation, that he was just being objective. Second interpretation is that this guy is rigid, that he has all his robes on, that they're all ironed, that he never lets he shaves his head every day, and he even in public he wears all his layers of robes. He never takes any of them off, even when he's traveling, and et cetera, et cetera. And that he's not, you can do that, that's great. But if he does it in a rigid way, then anybody else who does it isn't part of his view of the world. So then you begin to see the other interpretations, and you think, oh, okay, well, that's, I'm making interpretations, now there are others, and you can just loosen up a little bit. You just don't need that to do that so much anymore. And then the third one, which really takes zazen to do. You got to have a good zazen practice to do the third one. The third one is that you don't even create a samskara. You don't even create an emotion. You don't even do an interpretation. You don't even do them. I'm just listening. I hear the person saying these words. I have a felt sense of a little bit of tightness in my shoulders from these words. And maybe I say, oh, critical. Then I just let it go. We call that body and mind dropping away in Zen. It's not a big deal, but it takes a lot of practice for it to happen. It just happens after a while. It just happens. Not always. Not always, even if you sit arduously. But it begins to happen more and more. And so that your energy then is no longer invested in the emotional aggregate or the chattering and interpreting aggregate, but you're invested in just the sensory experience, just the feeling in your body, and just the perception. And then you just let it go. And sometimes you can even let it go before the perception. You can. You can. Just the sensory experience and just the feeling in your body. But you can't do it deliberately. You have to have a zazen practice to do that, or some kind of meditation practice. Well, you could try to do it deliberately, but what would happen when you try to do it deliberately? Try doing it deliberately. Tell me what happens. Well, you're trying to do it deliberately. It's Vijnana. It's the fifth one that's trying to do it. The fifth one always wants to be in control anyway. The interpreter wants to be in control. So the other side from, I'm going to tell the same example using the other side, and then we'll have a little conversation. The other side is, there I am at Soto Zen Buddhist Association in Oregon, hanging out with all these nice people, except those other people who aren't so nice. isn't that funny, the way we are as human beings? Doesn't it make you want to laugh or cry? So I'm there, and I hear someone I'm having a conversation with my friend Peter. I hear someone saying, that guy Tim Burkett is doing something quite interesting in the far north in Minnesota. Quite interesting. So I hear that. So So I hear that, and then right away my interpretation is, oh, wow, that guy is really pretty... pretty intuitive and pretty wise. I'm going to hang out with that guy. He really knows what's going on. Where is his center? I want to know where his center is. And then what? I have some scar, some fourth pride, joy about, oh, I'm a kindred spirit. And then I do some more interpretation. I think, well, when can I hang out with? Which one was he? Peter, who is that guy? Tell me about him. Peter said, oh, such and such. He lives in such. I said, oh, do you know him? And then I don't tell Peter what he said about me because I'm too modest. But, right? I mean, we do these things. Don't you do these things? Tell me you don't do these things. Tell me. Well, then, okay, but if I'm doing a Buddhist practice, then it's time for me to go into the bathroom or go out in the porch or something. Peter, excuse me for a minute. I'll be right back. Because I've invested all my energy in the fourth and fifth, and my ego is rigid. So I come back. I just take a break. I go out in the porch. Well, what did I hear? Well, I heard him say, Tim Burkett is doing something interesting. That's really all I heard, interesting. But, you know, I made something out of it. I made something out of it. And how did I feel? Oh, I felt warm. I'm reviewing it. I felt warm. I still feel warm when I think about it. In my heart area, right? Because that's where I tend to feel my warmth, not in my shoulders. Maybe you guys feel warmth in your shoulders, but when something positive happens, but not me, I feel, ooh, okay. I feel warm. And then my interpretation is, my perception is, he said something positive about what I'm doing. That's my perception. And my interpretation is, oh, that guy is really cool. I want to get to know that guy. Maybe I can give him some tips about how he should do his center. Maybe he can give me some tips, but I'm probably more advanced than him. Or whatever. Depending on how much egomania I have at the time, right? It's mania. We all have egomania. Everybody in this room, we all have egomania. That's why we need to do Buddhist practice. Because we are egomaniacal. All of us. All of us. We just don't admit it. We look good for a while. Everybody looks good for a while. All your moves are right for a while. But sooner or later, people catch on. People catch on. So, I can just see this. I can just feel this. I can just have the perception. Notice the interpretation. Notice the feeling of pride, the feeling of wanting to make connection. And bring it all into view, all five of them, and it depotentiates. Or, second step, I can then look at different interpretations. Well, all he said was what Tim Burton is doing is interesting. One interpretation is, well, he just was just interested. He's interested in everything, what everybody's doing. He's one of these people who's open. So he's interested in what Tim's doing, what Peter's doing, what John's doing, what Michael's doing, everything. He's just interested. So when I see the alternative interpretation, my ego mania will just settle down a little bit, right? I'll open up a little bit. I'll just be a little calm, a little more connected, a little less like, I want you to be my friends and you guys stay away. You know, the way we are as human beings. The way we're habituated to be as human beings, to protect ourselves. Because we think it's a hard world. And it is a hard world. But we make it harder on ourselves with this armor. This is armored protection. Armored protection that we do. Because we got hurt. We got people hurt us. So we armor ourselves. So then, the possibility also exists that I just hear, oh, that's interesting. I just feel warm. And I don't turn it into anything. I don't make anything out of it. I just go back to talking with Peter. I just go back to going outside and breathing the fresh air. And that's letting go of body and mind, which comes out of your sincere Zazen practice, your sincere meditation practice. So, I think that's what I want to say. And I'm hoping that some of you will have a little conversation. And some of you, if you don't give examples, that we can at least talk about this practice. Talk about this practice. So, questions, comments?
It seems to me that even if you are conflict avoidant, you still need to look at what your part was.
That's very good. That's very good. But when they say yes, the problem with that is that they use the term blame. If they didn't say drive all blame into one, looking at it is a very important part of it. Because you actually are doing it because your conflict avoidant is an internal mechanism that has exactly the same effect as the person who's aggressive. So looking at it with bare attention is really important. My only issue is with the term blame. And you know, that's these words, as they're translated from Sanskrit into Tibetan, into English, sometimes I don't know about the etymology. I have seen that one misused. As I saw these kinds of things misused in the Catholic Church in my childhood, with my grandmother and her friends. Do you know what I mean?
I don't know anything about that.
Oh.
No, but if we said introspection.
Introspection, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Introspection, but bare attention introspection rather than analytic introspection. You understand what I mean, Rosemary, by that. Analytic introspection so often gets into just monkey mind. Where I'm talking about bare attention.
Touching.
Yes, touching and go. Touch and go. Touch and go. Touch and go. Sure. Good question. Good question.
Point out what we do habitually, because even if we blame ourselves, we veer back and forth between blame others, blame ourselves.
That's right.
If you really look closely, you see that going on.
That's good. Yeah.
Oh, but then being useful then to let go.
Yeah, that's good. Thank you. Will?
Excuse me. I'm interested what you think in terms of relationships, friendships, romances, where, you know, if my partner says to me, I love you, you know, I don't think anyone in this room would tell me I should depotentiate that statement. It was sincere, there was no, like, you know, hidden agenda involved.
Okay, let's say your partner, this is a good one, let's see where we go with this one, okay? Let's say your partner says, I love you, and so where are you going with this? The important thing is that you experience the first three and not just four and five. That you experience both exactly what she said. You hear it exactly. You're really there with her when she says it. Or him. You're really there. And that you then get the felt sense. Get the felt sense. And that then you have a perception of, she loves me. That you don't get it, take off on, oh boy, she really loves me. I'm glad that she loves me so much. I want to do a better job of loving her. And I did a bad job before, and maybe she won't love me tomorrow if I don't do these dishes. And then all the samskaras that come up. Those are all the emotions that come up as you interpret. So with that one, it's the same. Come back to the first three. If you've lost them, come back to the first three. Because there's a tendency, even when someone says in intimacy, I love you, now, sometimes you're so still and you're so with them that you just take it in. You just really hear it. You really feel the warmth. And you don't need to get into creating a lot of emotional stuff and then a lot of interpretive stuff, creating a fire. You can just...
Because I was being in the moment.
Yes, this is all about being in the moment. This is a practice for. This is all Buddhism is, you know. All we're trying to do is help you come back to the fact that you're in a palace right now. You're the queen of the palace, the king of the palace, the Buddha nature. That's your nature. But it's only in this moment that the palace exists, the interdependence exists, the sense of communion. A sense of touching exists only now. So that's what all Buddhist practice is about. Right? And then from that, you can project. You need to project a future and a past. But if you're not really with your felt sense, that past, that future that you project is just a fabricated future by Vijnana, by monkey mind, and emotionally driven by samskara, by the together maker.
Is that right? Other together maker?
Yeah, samskara. Sam means together, skara means maker. So it brings together your your sensory experience, your felt sense, your perception, and then it brings them together so you can interpret. It has a social. There's a point to this. It has a social. So you can then interpret, and from your interpretation, you can make judgments. Those are fine. We need four and five as human beings, but the together maker takes over by making something out of it, by putting all kinds of experiences together based on our past memories and all of our emotions. So, just need to pay attention to the together maker. not put the together make it down. That's then the fifth one wants to put them all down, right? Vijnana, consciousness, wants to put them all down. I got to do this better. No, you don't have to do it better. Just do it. Just do it. Does that make sense, Will?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
And what if you get stuck in sensation mode? Do you think that what's the message there? Your perception is off, or you're not making sense of it?
So, for instance, so just say a little bit more about this, Alana.
If you're with someone in a situation, and let's say you're with someone with back pain or something.
Yeah.
And you're noticing after you leave the situation, you know, you're sort of running over what happened, and then you're noticing, oh, well, my back hurts.
That's a good example. Okay, so then you're sort of fixated on that sensation. Are you?
Yeah.
In this example?
Yeah. And I'm just wondering if to release that, I see it as a signal, but I don't.
Well, the first thing you would bring the skandhas into view, bring all five aggregates into view, because you're fixated. This does happen sometimes. You get fixated, and that's different than what I'm saying, but she's fixated on the second, in this case, on the second skandha, the second aggregate, the felt sense. Most people would want to be fixated on that. I mean, because we tend to ignore that. But in this case, she's really conscious of her body, and so much so that she's fixated on it. So you need to bring the other four into view. What was your sensory experience that preceded that? What's your perception about what happened? And how are you feeling emotionally? And what's your interpretation? You bring them all into view, and whatever one of the five you're fixated on, you bring them all into view. Does that make sense mm-hmm. to you?
So if you're still not able to release it, it's just you have to maybe come upon the right interpretation?
Well, sometimes it won't release right away. And need to look at different interpretations and go through it, and it won't release right away. And this is not a panacea. And the same thing is for doing this at the Soto Zen Buddhist Association. Yeah, I go out on the porch and I do this, and there might not be much release, but I'm committed to continuing to do that. And there's more release than I think. There's a little, if you actually do this, there's some release. Not as much as you want, but that's the samskara one. That's the fourth one that always wants more. We want this practice to work. That's why some of the Zen teachers say, don't do these techniques, because you want them to work. And then you're focused on, am I doing it well enough? I still got the sensation here. I didn't do it well enough. But it's not a question of well or not. Well, it's bringing the samskaras into view. Bringing them into view. See? And that does depotentiate the rigid ego. It just depotentiates it. But that's a very good example, Anna. A very good example.
Appreciating what you were talking about with pushing buttons. That I've been trying a bit lately, you know, when my buttons are pushed and I find something really, really annoying, it's like, what is it that is so annoying to me? And even if it's something a little far away from me, is just looking at it and saying, why am I so annoyed about this? What is it about myself? And am I annoyed because I manifest the same behavior in my own life?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's actually a way of saying, you know, I kind of feel it deeply because I screw up in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel like that's oftentimes why we get so annoyed and buttons pushed, because actually we can really relate to it because it's something
Thank you for working on that. Thank you all for working on this stuff, but working on it gently, working on it with lightness. Okay, don't turn it into this huge. I'm not so much talking to you. I'm just talking to everybody. That you know, these are meant to do in the lightness of our zazen mind. We're already here in the palace, you guys. We are here in the palace. Do you believe me? A little bit, you believe me. A little bit. Anything else? Thank you. Oh, is there someone else? Did I miss something?
I
Anda? Sure. Oh, well, the bare attention and touch and go. Okay, well, we say bare attention because we mean attention with no critical comment. And if you're really attentive, your critical mind just stops. If you're really attentive. So say we say bare. That means non-judgmental. We're not judging whether we're being attentive enough. If I'm judging whether I'm being attentive enough, I space out a lot, actually. You know, this is an irony about some Zen teachers, including my teacher, Suzuki Roshi. We space out a lot. We don't think when we space out. We don't know what, I don't know what we do. It's different than you guys. You guys have all kinds of thoughts and emotions. I don't know what happens to us. I'm not saying good or bad. It's just something. It's not very. It is bad, actually. I need to work on it. It's something I need to work on. Yeah. So the question was, about attention. See? Exactly. About attention. So it's non-critical, non-judgmental. That's why we say bare. And mindfulness is okay term too, but mindfulness again connotes that you need to do something. You don't need to do anything. It's just attention. It's your natural. Naturally, we are attentive. Look at a little baby. How attentive they are. Look at look at tiny children and grandchildren. They're attentive. So that's our natural way to just to be bare, with nothing, with no judgment, with no comparison, nothing. So then touch and go means that part of our bare attention means that we just attend to something, and then we don't make something out of it. If I attend to being with you completely, I'm just listening to you, I'm just being with you, then after you go, I don't have to create a story about our experience, because my experience was full with you. I was there with you. We were together in this. And afterwards, it's gone. It's gone. I'm touching something else, and that's gone. So the moment we really touch something, then we're able to really let it go, because we're not separate from it, and we touch it. And then we can go. So sometimes called the practice of touch and go. Okay? Is that all? Is that everything? Thank you.